Speech is silver, but silence is correct. Right you are. The first recorded use of this simple proverb in English was found in an 1833 novel written by Thomas Carlyle. Now, he attributed it to the Swiss. Others say it came from the Germans or the Dutch. Still others find a version of this maxim in ancient Arabic writings. And at least one of those Arab writers from so long ago attribute the saying to Solomon himself. And the book of Proverbs definitely does highlight the virtues of keeping quiet from time to time as we look at the different proverbs like Proverbs 10:19, 17:28. I'm guessing that this past week some of you heard family members say things that would have been better left unsaid at Thanksgiving around the table, right? No? Nobody? Maybe that's just a stereotype for no reason, but there are times when the best thing that we can do is not speak. We all know this. We've all learned this. And believe it or not, though, there are even times in the Bible when God did not want his people or the people to share the news about him. That may sound strange. It may not sound correct or right, but it's true. As an example, in Acts chapter 16, we have this very unusual situation where Paul the Apostle and his traveling companions made a great plan to launch a missionary effort into Asia. What could be wrong with that? Well, there's nothing wrong with it, but we're told that the Holy Spirit forbade them from speaking the word there. The Holy Spirit spoke to Paul and he says, "Don't you go preach the good news in Asia." Now, in this text, something similar happens. Jesus performs not only a wonderful healing miracle, but a specifically messianic miracle, as we'll see. But then he commands the witnesses there not to tell anyone. Of course, we've seen this before in the Gospels, but here it is explicit and repeated. The more he commands again and again, the more they do the opposite and they spread the word anyway. They refuse to stay silent. They refuse to obey the very same person that they went to for supernatural help. And it is an example to us that a person can have belief in God's power and a desire for God to provide for them or in their situation, but at the same time, absolutely ignore the heart work that he wants to do in them, in us. And so let's take a look at this interesting story. We begin in verse 31. Again, leaving the region of Tyre, he went by way of Sidon to the Sea of Galilee through the region of the Decapolis. Now, Jesus, if you were here a couple weeks ago, he has been in what we know as Lebanon today. It's the one time in the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus leaves Jewish territory, goes international, and he was in Tyre and Sidon. Those were different. That was a different nation. But now he heads back to the Decapolis. The Decapolis was a league of 10 Greek cities, and I find it sometimes hard to understand the geography of the region, and so I found a map that I thought was helpful, and so Jeff, if you'll put that map up for us. The Decapolis was really 10 cities. It was a league of 10 cities kind of together in the region that you can see there. And they were scattered throughout what we today would geographically call Syria, Jordan, and Israel. We don't know most of the cities, but a couple of them we do know. Damascus is one of the cities of the Decapolis, one of the 10 cities. So is Philadelphia, not Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia from Revelation when we read the letters to the seven churches. Now, 9 of these cities were on the east side of the Jordan River. And though some Jews lived there, these were squarely Gentile populations, specifically Greek in culture. Now, they had relative independence from Roman rule. Not total, but they were allowed to kind of do their own thing, and Rome kind of left them alone. It has to do with when they were established and all the, you know, different back and forth between the different generals and Caesars. But we we see this group of 10 towns, and we have to remind ourselves Jesus has gone to this place before, this general region. He's been in the Decapolis before. We read about it a few chapters ago in the Gospel of Mark when Mark talks about the region of the Gerasenes. So when Jesus crossed the sea and landed and that demoniac came out and he healed him and then the legion of demons went into the herd of pigs, that's part of the Decapolis. It's one of the cities of the Decapolis. Verse 32, they brought to him a deaf man who had difficulty speaking and begged Jesus to lay his hand on him. And so we commonly refer to this individual as being deaf and mute, but more precisely, he was deaf and unable to speak clearly. He had difficulty speaking. So it's not that he couldn't make any sound. We're not exactly sure. Either there was something wrong with his tongue or that he had some sort of serious speech impediment. The point is, he could not hear. He was absolutely deaf. But he couldn't speak effectively. He could not communicate. He might as well have been totally mute as well because his tongue was unable to form the words and sentences that he needed to in order to speak. Now, some friends or loved ones or whoever brought him that day to Jesus. And we've seen this many times before in the Gospel of Mark and the other Gospels as well. It's like when the friends brought the paralytic and broke through the roof and lowered him down there. The friends had heard Jesus was in the area, and so they go and they scoop up this man, their friend, and they bring him to Jesus. But what did they hope Jesus was going to do? Well, we say, well, they hoped he would heal him, but actually it's not quite clear what exactly they wanted. It does not say that they asked Jesus to heal their friend. They begged Jesus to lay his hand on him. Now, in Mark 1, when the leper comes to Jesus, he says, please cleanse me. In Mark 5, Jairus comes and says, put your hands on my daughter so she can get well. In the last passage, the Syrophoenician woman asked Jesus to cast the demon out of her daughter. And so you might think, well, what's the big deal? Obviously, they want him to heal their friend. But really, it's not quite as clear, given the wording and the level of shock that they show once the healing happens. It doesn't seem like they were actually counting on a miraculous healing, perhaps just a sort of religious blessing. Sometimes the Jews would lay hands on to confer religious blessing, similar to how in the church we will lay hands on people, you know, when they're commissioned or at different times of their lives. And when we're going to see that these guys are absolutely shocked that their friend is healed. But even so, it's great that they came to Jesus. Whatever it is they were specifically looking for, if maybe they didn't know what they were looking for, because these are pagans in the Decapolis, it's great that they came looking for Jesus, that they heard Jesus of Nazareth was in the area again, and this time they went to him hoping for help. They begged him for help, it says. That by itself is a major development and a major contrast from the last time Jesus was in the Decapolis. The last time Jesus was in this area, what did we see? He cast the demon out of that guy, and what did the people do? They begged him to leave. They said, you have to go right now. We don't care that you worked a miracle. We don't care who you are. Maybe we've heard things about you, but you got to get out of here. And then he did leave. But before he left, what did Jesus tell the man who had been set free from the demon? He says, go and tell the people of the Decapolis the great things God has done for you. And clearly, he was faithful to go through those 10 towns, proclaiming how much Jesus had done for him and sharing his testimony of God's power and grace, sharing the testimony of what Jesus of Nazareth could do, so that now the next time Jesus was here, people come running to him instead of driving him out of their land. And it's a great little, you know, example and testimony to us of how, as the Lord works in our lives, we can't always control how people are going to respond, or, you know, we can't force people to accept the gospel. But what matters is that as God works in our lives and as we submit to his work in our lives, we share the good news of what Jesus has done, and we proclaim the good things that God has done for us. And then the rest is up to the Holy Spirit to work on the lives of the people around us. And so it's interesting. It's not the demoniac who brought these people, but he had gone out and said, hey, here's what Jesus did for me. You guys aren't in, you know, oh, that rabbi from Nazareth, who cares about that? We're cosmopolitan Greeks. We're free from Rome. We're all of these things. And he says, okay, well, let me tell you. You know, you knew me. I was that guy breaking chains and running around naked in a graveyard and attacking people and full of demons. You all know me. And let me tell you about what Jesus has done, why I'm in my right mind and why my life is completely different. And so he went through telling how much God had done for him, how much Jesus had done for him. And now, quite some time later, you know, it's not specific, but quite some time later, the seeds of that gospel message are starting to bear fruit. As Jesus comes back again, and now people are like, well, if he did this for this other guy, maybe he'll do something for me. Maybe he'll do something for my friend. We're not even sure what he can do in this case, but let's go to him anyway. And so as you're moving around in the world, all of us would do well to just remind ourselves to pray to the Lord for boldness and for opportunity to just share not about what we've done for God, but what God has done for us. The truth of Jesus Christ, his power, his ability, his goodness, his faithfulness, his mercy, his compassion, his truth. And to just say, man, Lord, send me into whatever towns, you know, you want me to go and give me opportunity to talk about you in a way that is backed up by the work that you're doing in and through my life. So now we have this deaf guy before Jesus, and believe it or not, this is the first example of a deaf person being healed in Mark's gospel. And Mark's was the first gospel written, so this is the sort of first record of Jesus healing a deaf person. And we might not immediately track with how significant that is, how important it is that Jesus was able to heal the deaf. Now, we're here. Most of us are very familiar with the Bible and familiar with Jesus. We love Jesus. We understand who he is. But remember, he has come, and the whole point of this book is, who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Because Jesus came to reveal the truth about who he was, and the things he was doing was revealing the truth about who he was. Now listen, we know that Jesus worked a countless number of healing miracles. John says, if you tried to write down all the things that Jesus did, the world couldn't contain the books. And we've seen these moments where he's just, you know, from dawn till dusk, just constantly healing and interacting with people. But remember, Jesus' purpose was to preach that the kingdom of heaven was at hand and to reveal that he was the long-expected Messiah that had been promised and foretold by the Old Testament prophets. And so Mark will often gloss over these long periods of Jesus' healing ministry. He doesn't record that many healings compared to what Jesus did. He says, oh yeah, you know, and then they were here and they were so busy, no one could even eat, and they were there all day and they were there the whole weekend, and, you know, and he just kind of glosses over, and all of those things are full of healings because, as Mark is pointing out, Jesus's primary purpose in arriving was not just to show, hey, I can do cool miracles, was not to be a miracle worker, though he worked a huge number of miracles, but his purpose was to preach. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. I am the Son of Man. I am the Messiah, and you need to receive me as I have been revealed. At the same time, there were specific indicators, signs and wonders that Jews could and should watch for so that they could know the Messiah when he arrived. You see, the Old Testament prophets are full of descriptions and indications to the people of God, the Jews, that when the Messiah arrives, here's how you will know him. Here's what the Messiah will be doing. Because God didn't want to come in a way and not have them know. I mean, he came and he wanted them to know. Now, I am the Messiah you've been waiting for all of this time. The one that God promised back in the Garden of Eden, the one that Moses said, watch for this coming prophet. All the Old Testament prophets said, hey, the Messiah is coming one day to do what needs doing for our nation and for the world and for our hearts. And so there's all of these prophecies that say, here's how you'll know the Messiah. Here's one, he'll come out of Bethlehem. Here's one, he'll be born of a virgin. But then a lot of prophecies about what the Messiah will do so that when you see someone doing that, you can know, oh, this is the one we've been waiting for. Indicators and descriptions like Isaiah 35, 5 and 6. Let me read these to you. Here is your God. Vengeance is coming. God's retribution is coming. He will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer and the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. For water will gush in the wilderness and streams in the desert. And like so many Old Testament prophecies, that passage in Isaiah has both an early and a yet future fulfillment. Much of the Old Testament prophecies have a now and not yet fulfillment. And so ultimately, Isaiah's passage there does look forward to the millennium, but it also explains how to recognize the Messiah when he comes. And when Mark describes the speech defect of the man in our text, he uses what linguists call an extremely rare word, a word that is only used twice in all the Bible. Once here in Mark 7:32, describing this man, and then once in the Greek version of the Isaiah passage I just read, the Septuagint. And so those are the only two places in the whole Bible that uses this word for muteness that we're talking about here. And so this is a very important, very significant miracle. And Mark clearly wants us to think so the way he depicts it. In fact, he is the only gospel writer to include this particular healing. And so Mark is the shortest gospel. He's moving. He leaves some things out sometimes. You know, he says, hey, this is what we're getting to. We're showing that Jesus is the Messiah. But he pauses us and he says, hey, we need to talk about this one miracle where Jesus healed this deaf mute. And he uses this word that only applies to that Isaiah passage. Verse 33, so he took him away from the crowd in private. After putting his fingers in the man's ears and spitting, he touched his tongue. Has anybody ever really liked receiving a wet willy? I haven't, right? Are you the kind of person, you don't have to raise your hand, are you the kind of person that will drink after another person? How about milk? There are people who say, well, I'll drink soda or water after someone, but there's something about milk. There's a mucusiness about it. It's like, I'm not drinking milk after somebody else. Ever shared gum that someone had already chewed? See that in movies sometimes. I always feel so bad for the actors. When I was in college, for a couple years I worked for, or for 1 year I worked for Student Life, and at the beginning every year they had to do orientation for the freshmen who lived on campus and had to tell them, hey, these are the rules, you know, things they could do, couldn't do in their dorm rooms, no hot plates, that kind of stuff. But nobody cares about that, so we had to make it fun. So we would have this orientation with these skits. Now, one of them, I did some things I'm not proud of in those things, but one of the things they did every year that I always refused to do was they were trying to tell the freshmen, you need to have a good hygiene. And so they had like a line of 10 people, and everyone had a toothbrush, and so they would brush their teeth, drink spit, pass it, brush their teeth, drink spit, pass it, brush their teeth, and then the 10th person just drank it. Yeah. I don't think I did that. I don't think so. I don't think I would have physically been able to do it. I had a much worse one where you can't have pets, right? And so the skit was, you know, the RA comes into my room and he keeps finding accoutrement for pets. And so like they find, you know, the dog treat and they say, you have a dog? No, that's mine. And I ate that. And then something else. The worst was the bird seed. They had a brick of bird seed, and I thought, this won't be hard. And I almost died after taking a bite of bird seed. You can't, it's like putting 10 saltines in your mouth at once. There's not enough liquid. Anyway. And unfortunately, that culminated in me swallowing a fish. So it's okay. All right, anyway. So Jesus does something kind of like that in this passage. It's a little different. Do you really imagine Jesus spitting and pawing on somebody's tongue? I don't. And you know, it's not the only time Jesus used saliva when healing someone. He's going to do so again when healing a blind man in chapter 8. Spits on his eyes, rubs mud on there. It's kind of strange. What is this about? Some scholars talk about how, you know, other pagan healers in this era and time would do these sort of actions with spit and poultices and things. And so, you know, they say, well, the people in this region, they'd be familiar with that. But, you know, Jesus Christ does not do incantations, right? Jesus Christ doesn't imitate pagan occult healers. He's God of very God. He is the creator. He can and has in this gospel healed from afar with a thought, with no words. So he usually just heals by words. But so what's up with this? We can't exactly know why. And the truth is Jesus didn't have one method for how he healed people. But what can we see here? What might we observe from what Mark has said? Well, we see that Jesus wanted to have a personal interaction with this fellow. It brings him away from the crowd, though his friends and the disciples were still there. And let's think about it this way. Jesus cannot verbally ask this man if he wants to be healed. Often people come to Jesus, and he says, hey, what do you want me to do for you? And he tests their faith. He evaluates where their faith is, what their belief is, why they come to him. That was kind of the purpose of his interaction with the Syrophoenician woman in the very last passage. But he can't ask this man. He's deaf. He can't hear him. And the man can't verbally communicate whether he has faith or not, whether he agrees with being there with Jesus or not. If the man was illiterate, they couldn't write him a message like we see happen with Zechariah in Luke 1 when he is, it seems, deaf and mute as well. And so now here's Jesus saying, okay, I'm going to touch your tongue. And he's putting his fingers in his ears. He is getting up close and personal to a serious degree. And so the question is this, would the man rest his head away from Jesus' probing action? Would he recoil? Or would the man submit, invasive and awkward as this interaction might be? Have you ever had a stranger do this to you? Walk up to you and start poking you? Of course not. But if they did, what would you do? You would recoil. You would push them away. You would rest your head out of their grasp. But if you believe they could heal you, if you had faith and trust in this person, then that would be different. We don't usually permit this kind of hands-on intrusion even from our friends, right? Nobody really wants the wet willy. We maintain personal space. But there are certain people, think about it, there are certain people where we would allow to do things like this in certain situations. Physicians, for one. Man, a doctor can do whatever they need to do to you, especially if we're talking about a surgeon or a necessary treatment, right? Personal space and personal dignity and personal boundaries and all of that all goes out the window if you're in a situation where you need a doctor to get up close and personal and hands-on. Or also parents, you know, like when you were young, maybe your dad would help you, grab you and help you get that splinter out of your foot or out of your hand, or check for the lice in your hair very closely and you know, peeling it all apart and kind of grabbing you, get his hands in your mouth when you're losing a tooth. And so there are times where these sort of boundaries and defenses, we let them go because of what is necessary and because of who that person is. And on a devotional level, Jesus Christ is meant to have total access to your heart and your mind and your life. Total access. Like a father, like a physician, a surgeon, like the closest, most trusted person you've ever known. That if he wants to put his hands into your mouth, you realize that I need to let him do that. This is what David understood in his famous Psalm 139, right? What did he say? Lord, search me and know me. Investigate and find out by means of personal exploration. That's what David was saying. Expose in me any weakness or sickness or dry rot or infection so that you can lead me in your everlasting way. Invade whatever you need to in order to make me right with you. Verse 34, looking up to heaven, he sighed deeply and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. Ephphatha is probably Aramaic. A few scholars think it's Hebrew. I find it interesting that in his incarnation, it seems so silly to say this, I've said it before, but in his incarnation, Jesus knew and spoke three languages. He's God. He knows all the languages. But he knew and spoke three languages, Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic. But note, it wasn't the spit that healed the man. It wasn't the, you know, the interaction of his hands. It was the Lord's word. And we're told that as Christ uttered this word, Jesus sighed deeply. The term refers to an inarticulate sound that expresses strong emotion. And you know I need the reminder that Jesus was emotional. He had real emotion. His heart overflowed with compassion. We've seen that before, with care, with love, at times with frustration or anger, always in godly perfection, never in a way that, you know, he would have to apologize for. It was always right. But Jesus was not some weird robotic, you know, personage. If you, you know, are old enough to have seen the Jesus of Nazareth, you know, miniseries from a million years ago, Jesus doesn't even seem like a human being. He seems like a weird alien that is like never emoting and never blinking and never acting like a regular person. But man, the Lord has real emotion. God is the creator of emotions. And today, Jesus continues to really feel. He has genuine affection and love towards you. And he has genuine heartache when we disobey him, when we push him away, when we doubt him, when we rest our heads out of his hands and say, no, you can't stick your fingers in my ear. You can't stick your fingers in my mouth. Verse 35, immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak clearly. If I was ranking miracles, this one probably wouldn't make the top 10 in terms of excitement or spectacularity, right? It's just, to me, if I'm reading, I'm like, oh yeah, he healed a deaf guy. That doesn't seem like a big deal. But this was a major moment in messianic news. This is a big deal. And it's a biblical deal that's happening here. Jesus did something that only God could do. And we would assume, like the friends, that the best thing would be to get the word out to as many people as possible, but that's not what Jesus wanted. Verse 36, he ordered them to tell no one, but the more he ordered them, the more they proclaimed it. Now, we've seen this sort of thing happen before in the Gospel of Mark, but if we stop to think about it, think about this scene. Jesus is repeatedly saying, don't tell anybody about what just happened. The more he tells them, the more they do it. This is shocking disobedience. He didn't just ask them once, but again and again. And so it's such a strange scene. They come to Jesus because they think he has something he can do for their friend. He went above and beyond what they expected. And they watch him supernaturally heal both the hearing and the speech of this crippled man. And then when Jesus turns to them and gives them this one simple directive, they immediately and repeatedly disregard him. No, we're not going to do it. Verse 37, they were extremely astonished and said, he has done everything well. He makes even the deaf hear and the mute speak. And so it is an understatement to say that their minds were blown. They were not expecting this to happen. Extremely astonished, that Mark uses here, is a Greek term that is only used here in all of Greek literature, according to scholars. That it's so mind-blowing, they were astonished beyond all measure in the extreme, is what Mark is saying here. And they were absolutely amazed and convinced of Jesus' goodness and his power. He does all things well. And yet, they were unwilling to bring themselves under his direction. Unwilling to bring themselves under his care and his command. They brought their friend, who probably had little idea what was going on at first, had little idea who Jesus was, what he needed to do. But the man's friends thought, okay, listen, man, sit here and do whatever this guy wants you to do, and your life is going to be all the better for it. And he opens the man's mouth, and the man is able to speak clearly. And then when Jesus turns to them and sort of metaphorically says, and now I want to close, I opened his mouth, I want to close your mouth, they say, absolutely not. No matter how many times you ask, we're going to do the opposite. When it comes to their turn to interact with the Messiah, they keep their independence. They keep their own control and rule over their tongues. As the Decapolis stayed uncontrolled by the Caesar, so these men refused to be controlled by the Redeemer. And so we have this amazing juxtaposition, really. At the scene of a deaf, mute man being healed, the men who can hear won't listen to what Jesus is saying, and they will not close their mouths at his command. Their hearts were deaf to the Lord. What's worse, deaf ears or deaf hearts? Now, they had genuine excitement, and they obviously had a measure of belief. He does all things well, and they recognize, hey, you worked this miracle. They had some sort of good desire toward their friend and to tell what they had seen. But face to face with Jesus, when he says, this is what I'm asking of you, do not tell anyone, they would not obey. They would not bow their hearts and their minds to the will of Jesus. Everything he does is good. Doesn't that include his commands and his directives? This scene not only reveals something magnificent about Jesus, it also reveals something malicious in all of our rebel hearts. All of us have rebel hearts. That's the sin nature. Every last one of us, born dead in trespasses and sins, at war with God, that sin nature that needs to be crucified, right? And now, when we've been born again, we are dead to sin, and yet that sin nature still operates within us. And that's why we're told so often in the New Testament, hey, you have to resist the devil. You have to flee temptation. You have to buffet that sin nature. You have to crucify that sin nature so that you can put down the rebellion that lives in all of our hearts and will until we step through death into eternity. We are prone to spiritual deafness, all of us. We're prone to be excited about God's provision, but not so much about his correction or his restrictions or his dominion of our lives. We know that he does all things well, that Jesus is altogether good, that he is altogether correct, that he is altogether right. But we have to remind ourselves that that goodness, that rightness, includes his commands. And his commands are many. They are good, but many in number that apply to us, that are demanded of us. His goodness and wellness extends to his directives in our lives. Even when they don't make sense, even when they challenge our self-governance and our desire to do this, that, or the other thing, Jesus says, I have an opinion on what you should be doing in your life, on what you should or should not be saying. And it's not just pagan Greeks in the Decapolis. In a few verses, Jesus is going to have a frank and direct talk with his disciples. And once again, they're not grasping what Jesus has been trying to reveal to them, what he's been trying to teach them. And so in chapter 8, he will say, very tellingly, and this is why Mark puts all of these things together, he says, don't you understand or comprehend? Do you have hardened hearts? Do you have eyes and do not see? Do you have ears and not hear? Well, yeah, we can hear you. Okay, but why aren't you listening to me? Why aren't you obeying what I'm telling you to do? Where is your faith? Jesus asked them. And so it's not just the physical ears that can be deaf. As always, the primary healing work needs to be done in the heart, in our hearts, in my heart, in your heart, so that God can transform and conform us, so that he can continue to do his good work. He does all things well, including the work he wants to do in your life, through your life, opening up your life for his purposes and his glory, so that he can then lead us in the everlasting way, sending us out with his message to proclaim, his words on our lips, his truth in our hearts, his work of exploring, evaluating, diagnosing, and transforming us as the Father, the physician, the Lord that He is.